Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Solutions for the Underaffiliated, the show for people who want positivity, hope, and examples of improving the overall health of humanity. I'm DJ EJ, and I'm with my co-host Habanero.
Good morning.
We're going to be talking today with David Weintraub. He's the executive director of the Center for Cultural Preservation and a filmmaker. David, welcome. To kick us off, would you please tell us a little bit about yourself, the Center for Cultural Preservation, and what you're working on these days?
Sure. So the center was founded, was my brainchild. I founded this about, 10, 15 years ago, 15 years ago. I'm going to go with that one. But I've been working on these issues for a long, long time. And it's been a period of evolving from being an environmentalist, being a community organizer, being a civil rights lawyer, and just being someone who loves culture and history and nature and trying to connect all those things together. And so my life has kind of always been on the intersection of cultural heritage preservation and natural heritage protections. And so the center was founded, I was running ECO, the Environmental and Conservation Organization, for a number of years. It was it ultimately merged with WNC Alliance. It became Mountain True. And so I was an environmental advocate in Henderson County, Polk, and Transylvania County. And what I discovered pretty quickly was the people who should mostly be concerned about what we do were the people who've been here for generations. And those were the people who never came. You know, environmentalists would talk about all those terrible natives, those conservatives, they just don't understand. But it was the newcomers who were building the massive developments up on steep slopes. It was they who were building the McMansions. And there was a real disconnect that the people here whose blood, sweat, and tears were in the soil and in the land were not connected to the environmental efforts because we weren't speaking their language. And so that's why I founded the Center for Cultural Preservation is we need to speak the language of the people who live here, not just the vernacular of, you know, the left or whatever that is. And wherever I've always lived, I've started an oral history project. So I thought that was just a wonderful way of being able to connect with the people who've lived here for so many generations is to record their lives and to preserve the history here and the culture and the connection to the environment and to nature by having them tell their stories. And so over the course of a number of years, I've collected about 500 oral histories. I'm about to launch my 50th documentary film. And basically connect people to the history of this place, the culture of this place, and the fact that we're all part of this common tapestry that's woven with common threads.
So you mentioned that you were a lawyer, you're an organizer. How did that inform, you know, where you are today?
I ran like the plague from being an attorney. I wanted to help people with law. As a community organizer, I actually founded a legal organization that was representing low-income African-Americans. And to do that, you know, I would work with volunteer attorneys. And after a while, I just realized turning a corporate lawyer into somebody who really cares about average people was putting lipstick on a pig. So I decided I was going to go back to law school and try to do it myself. But it was hard because, you know, I had to deal with other lawyers. I love representing clients and I love fighting the good fight. But the legal system was so dysfunctional and it was driving me crazy. But it certainly helped me be a precise, focused person. And it also taught me that, you know, it's really the community organizing. It's really the day-to-day work with people that's most important. And that so many of the issues that we face, we can change through engaging with people. And so I think it really did. It helped me become a better writer. It helped me become more focused. And it helped me I think being a lawyer helped me be less victimized about the system. Because if you understand, I always love to understand how things work. And by understanding how things work, you can help teach people how to change things around them. that's certainly helped. I love cultural stuff and artistic stuff and environmental things so much more than the lawyering and that I was doing. And you know, certainly community organizing comes into play in anything you do if you want to do it right. If you want to do it with people, you know, there's lots of filmmakers who work with corporations and they tell a story, but the story never gets told the way it should be told because the money is really talking more than they are. And I've seen so many great projects kind of disappear because the money is speaking a whole lot louder than they are. And so it makes my job a lot more difficult because making a film is in a professional manner is very, very expensive to do. And so I have to spend a lot of time pounding the pavement to raise the funds. But I think my story has become more authentic as a result. My blood pressure might be higher, but the stories are more authentic.
Well, so let's talk about your stories then. So what's something or a handful of stories that you're working on now or completed right now that you want to share with folks?
Well, the film that's about to be released, it's having its world premieres over the next few days, June 24th, June 29th, and July 1st, Nature's Wisdom Through Native Eyes. And that's a film that I've been thinking about for a long time. And it's in many ways, it's the culmination of the work I've been doing for a long time. And so where this came about, I guess this came about because my mother was a storyteller, and the stories she loved to tell were the Jack Tales, but also the stories about the Iroquois and the Cherokee and the Zuni and the Apache and all these stories I grew up with, I just loved, especially the ones that were about nature, especially the ones that were about the tree people and the possum people and the frog people. And I just assumed that these were just wonderful metaphors about this close relationship the native people had with the living world. But actually I was wrong because it was a whole lot more than that. Western culture sees humans at the top of the ladder where everything else, plants and animals, are far below. But native people see it completely different. They see that plants and animals were the first to come. And so they are our teachers on how to live and how to connect with each other. And it's how we learn from each other and from the environment. And so I thought, what a fascinating way to tell this story about, it's so easy to tell an environmental story and pound people with facts and tell, you know, people on alarm and scare the bejesus out of them. And also make sure that they never get involved in the environment again because they're so frazzled by the facts and the information. And I think the great environmentalists that I love, John Muir and Rachel Carson and others like that, they were inspiring people. And so I wanted to make an inspiring film, and Native people who talk about the environment are inspiring. And so I wanted to learn from them who were learning from the plants and animals around us. And so that's kind of where this is, you know, so that basically the tagline of this film is through the confluence of native wisdom, nature's intelligence, and storytelling, we can better understand the living world and how to repair our broken relationship with it.
So David, tell us why that's valuable. You said something earlier, which I think is interesting, which is a lot of times documentaries can hit folks over the head. It's just facts. When we were all in school, we had documentaries force-fed to us, right? What's the value of your approach in talking about these natural processes?
Well, I can tell you from experience, I used to run a film festival in Hendersonville for about 5 or 6 years. It was an environmental film festival. And we tried to pick, you know, glean some of the best environmental films we could find around the country, as well as locally. But I used to kid with my volunteers to make sure that there was no sharp objects on the way out, because these films were devastating for the most part. They weren't inspiring. They certainly told you the facts. They weren't lying. But you felt so angry and upset and disoriented. You know, you didn't feel like you wanted to run out and do something good. You just felt overpowered. And so that taught me a really important lesson, is that there's a way you can tell this story that makes people grateful and connected, and there's a way you can tell the story that makes people sad and basically uninvolved. And that's kind of where I think we are these days. Environmental despair in my mind, is just as destructive as clear cutting old growth forest and poisoning our rivers and streams and with pesticides and denial. That's what I've learned. And yet, what Native people were teaching me, and I interviewed, I've been working with the Eastern Band of Cherokee and the Waccamaw in South Carolina and the Muckasuckee in South Florida and the Seminole and many different tribes over many years. And what I've learned from them is this deep connection that they had with the land. They weren't looking at the world through their window. We see the natural world through the office window or a home window or the window in our car. Yet they're living in nature. It is part of their makeup. And so it's this deep connection with the natural world. And so we have these two competing stories, and that's where this film comes about, is the story of gratitude and reciprocity, with living with the world in a way that inspires us and inspires the plants and animals around us. Or it's the other story of our divine right to extract and deplete to oblivion every blessed thing on this planet, leading to the pollution of our air, land, and water. And so I don't pull any punches in my films, but I also try to tell these stories in a way that doesn't inspire despair, but inspires love. What I grew up with Jacques Cousteau, and Jacques Cousteau, the wonderful underwater photographer and filmmaker, always said that you only protect what you love. And so that's what this film and so many of my films are about, is helping engender that love with the land. Because if you don't have the love, then all of it is just intellectualizing ultimately.
What's the name of your film again?
Nature's wisdom through native eyes.
Another question I have is related to this idea of love. You don't protect it if you don't love it. How do you help people who are, they'll say I'm busy and they may not connect to the environment? I mean, we live in a world of brick and mortar. We live in cars and coffee shops, and we don't necessarily see the world around us. How do we connect?
I guess it starts with your own backyard. Even if you don't have a backyard, your spiritual backyard. Right now, I'll give you an example. I have a little yard in the back, and every year I try to put in some more raised beds. So I'm growing the lettuce. I'm growing arugula. I'm growing sweet peas, and I just picked the largest turnips I've ever seen in my life. And I put my summer vegetables in, and they're starting to grow, and that's wonderful. And we have something to eat, and I get to share that with my neighbors, who are mostly elderly people who don't do any growing anymore. But the thing that I'm growing most of all, that I love the most, is I'm growing clover on my front yard, much to the chagrin of my neighbors. Every neighbor in my neighborhood, it looks like it's a golf course. Not mine, and I'm sure, people, as they driving by, they say, "What the heck is wrong with this person?" But I'm seeing the bees, and I'm seeing all these pollinators who are congregating on what would have been this dead grass that only is terrible for the environment. It's terrible for climate change. It fosters stormwater runoff when it rains, and it always rains here. And so a simple thing like that is not cutting your lawn every week, just letting nature take over a little bit. Looking at the world as a partnership, rather looking at it as what can I get from it? Even as a gardener, is that gardeners tend to be consumers as well. We look at what can I get rather than what can I put back. And so for perennials, for instance, I'm growing asparagus and strawberries, right? I just put them in this year. And so it's so easy to say, "I want strawberries, I want strawberries, I'm going to pick them all." But really, if I want that strawberry plant to grow and prosper and live long, 10, 15 years, I have to snip off those flowers. It breaks my heart to do that because I love berries. But I have to do that because I want that strawberry to grow. I want its roots to plant deeply in the ground. I want to grow companion plants that give that strawberry, like nasturtium, gives it minerals and vitamins and things that it can get from this, it can't get by itself. You know, the native people always had the three sisters, the corn and the squash, and the beans that, you know, all give something to each other. And so if we look at every part of our life as a partnership with our fellow man, with our fellow animals, with our fellow plants, rather than what can I get from this relationship, it puts everything in the world on a different plane. And even if you don't have a, you know, a backyard, you know, you just have a window and you put a little container in the south-facing window that you hopefully have to grow something. It's just finding opportunities to connect with nature and finding opportunities to connect with each other rather than finding the lines of why I'm different than you. Even on the people on the left, you know, we're fighting each other about little minor stupid things that make absolutely no sense in my mind. We live on a finite planet and we're living as if we have all the resources in the universe forever. And it's clear that that's not the case. So what is it? How does it start? It starts with your own backyard.
So, David, how do you feel when you do all of these things, when you experience that connection to native culture or something like that?
Well, personally, I feel inspired. I feel the love. I feel like I want to stand up on the mountaintop and yell to everybody who can listen that there's a way that, you know, we can live in joy and harmony and happiness. And we can, even if I'm having a really hard day and someone cut me off on, you know, 26 and I had this terrible, you know, someone said something really nasty about me somewhere else or whatever. You know, if I go back to the garden, even if I get stung by a bee while I'm gardening, it just, you know, we have to get back to basics, you know, and the basics are the land that we live on. When I sit, you know, as I said, I've done almost 500 oral histories. And when I sit down across from an elder, whether that elder be Cherokee or African American or Scots-Irish or what have you, I always feel like this is the richest person that I've ever spoken to. And the reason why is, I mean, they probably didn't have two nickels to rub together for the most part, for most of their lives, but they were connected to the land, they were connected to each other, they were connected to their faith. And that's the richness. You know, I have stuff, I have things, you know, I have devices coming out of the yin yang, but those things I've never experienced on the level that they did. And they've had hard lives. They struggled. I mean, there was no running water for so many people. The bathroom, you know, the toilet paper was the Montgomery Ward or Sears catalog. I mean, you had today we buy stuff and then, you know, after a year we throw it off on the side of the road, go to Walmart and get another one. But if you needed something in the old days, you made it. And if something broke, you fixed it. So I feel joyful knowing those things. And I feel joyful that maybe I can learn a few of those things. And I've, you know, my favorite apple butter recipe is from, you know, one of the elders that I've spoken to. I mean, joy you get from doing those things.
Hey, David, real quick, why don't you tell us again what the dates are when folks can see nature's wisdom through native eyes and where they can see it?
Oh, sure. So Saturday, June 24th at North River Farms. That's in Mills River Road. That's a drive-in theater. And so it's a big farm, and you can come there, park your car. You can sit in your car if you want to, but even better is, you know, bring your camp chair and sit under the stars. And we have Michelle Skeel, a wonderful native flautist, who's going to be playing some music, and then we'll be showing the film, and then we'll have discussion. We'll have some of the native folks who are in the film and some of the scientists who are in the film be there for questions and discussion afterwards. There'll be a food truck. We did this. My last major film came out 2 years ago in the middle of COVID, and so everything had to be outside. And people, everyone loved it. You know, I love drive-in theaters, not just to bring my girlfriend, but it was just, you know, it's just kind of fun to do that, to have that experience. It's more of a communal experience than sitting in the dark in some theater somewhere.
Yeah.
So
But
if
that.
somebody were to miss that, let's just say you're going to be out of town and you're going to miss that great in-person event experience, how else might people be able to see that, particularly people who might be listening to this show after it airs?
Well, then the next one is Thursday, June 24th at the Orange Peel. At 7:30, and so people can come there and watch the film there, listen to the music. We have a wonderful Cherokee flutist, Jarrett Wildcat, who will be performing there as well. Then the third date, July 1st, is at Trinity Presbyterian Church in Hendersonville at 7:30. And so those are the three live events where you get to experience that with the music and the film and the discussion. But I know what you're saying is that if you can't physically come to any of those things, we will be having a virtual showing as well in the fall. I don't have a date for that yet because I like to, after I do my showing, have my nervous breakdown, be able to take a breath. Because the irony, of course, is when you're making films about these wonderful things, making films is a very overwhelming process. And it's I do most of it myself. And yeah, the exhaustion does kind of seep in. But it's nice for me also to go to these showings and I can sit back and say, it's over.
I'll bet. Real you quick, I want to clarify something. I think you said to start the show, I think you said one of the showings was June 24th. Was the next one June 24th or June 29th?
June 29th, I'm sorry.
Okay, June 29th and then July 1st in Hendersonville. Why is it so difficult to preserve some of these cultures, and what are the consequences of not preserving them?
The consequences of the loss of the natural world around us, the living world, is that we're spending so much time distracting ourselves on devices that we often forget that we're part of that world. And so when we lose that, we're losing a part of ourselves. I feel deeply when, I'm driving by on the road and I see a big truck with lots of trees, being hauled away that used to be trees and now we're going to be something else. It does pain me, but at the same time, we're living in an industrialized society. And so I have to have gratitude for what has been preserved and has been protected and strive myself, and rather than being despaired about what's happening around me, is try to seek preserving what we do have. I guess one of the things we explore in the film that I kind of would like to go into for a second, just to answer your question, is we have scientists in the film, in addition to lots of Native elders as well, who are basically verifying that Western science is just starting to catch up with this ancient wisdom about these connections. For instance, recent research confirms that trees are connected to each other through mycorrhizal fungal networks. And now we know that trees actually share resources with each other. They can communicate with each other, that a mother tree can actually distinguish its seedlings from the seedlings of another tree of the same species and will actually send carbon to those seedlings. Because, think of the forest. You have this forest and the big trees are getting to the sun and that's how they make carbon. But the little seedlings, they can't do that by themselves. And so there's so much intelligence in this world. And if we understood, we kind of poo-poo that intelligence. Oh, it's just a tree, or he's just a tree hugger. But, these things have been around. Our lives are little specks, we live and die, and they can live hundreds, in some cases, thousands of years. And so there's this whole communication pattern that Native people have been talking about for generations, thousands of years, that when they talk about the tree people. And I was just thinking, oh, that's just a metaphor, but it's true. A tree will actually, they found scientific evidence that a tree can actually alert other trees if there's harm. If there's predators attacking this tree, then the tree can let other trees know about that. And so they can warn themselves, there's chemical reactions that occur to ward off those things. And so the more we know about the natural world around us, that this is just a tree, this is just a dog, this is just a black bear that we have to avoid, when we understand the intelligence, the complexity of their relationships, that animals and plants have incredible intelligence, it's just different than ours. Ours, we can push a button and blow everything up. Theirs, they have, for thousands, if not millions of years, have had to find a way to live with each other. And that's where the intelligence comes in for us. If we can get some humility back and realize how much wisdom there is in what's around us, all of a sudden, it changes our whole perspective.
So even if people believe in acting in a certain way to protect the climate or slow climate change or something like that, why do you think people struggle with acting on this natural connection you have? You know, and I think you brought up a great example. Yes, we can learn about the signs of how trees communicate. That's a great example. But generally speaking, our own history proves that we do not often act on what we know. So why do you think people struggle with knowing things to be true about the natural world and not acting on them?
Part of it is that we've lost connections to our own cultural and historic, our own culture and our own history. I mean, how we don't have to go that far back in our own family history to know where our farmers were. You know, my grandmother was a chicken farmer in what's now called Belarus. You know, that, then it was Poland and sometimes it was Russia. It was that's how she made her living. And all of a sudden she was in Brooklyn and Lower East Side and then Brooklyn and living in this industrial world. And she had to cope with that. But we don't have to dig that deep in our own cultural history where we had these deep connections to nature as well. I think that part of why it's so hard is because we've found so many ways to distract ourselves from what's right. You know, when people ask, well, how do you find joy? The first thing I say is throw away your smartphone because it's an addiction. It's a drug. I don't even have one. You know, it does become frustrating, but I have a little flip phone, I've realized I have to have something. It has some rudimentary functions there, but I can't, you know, I can't sit there and stare at that screen, even if I wanted to. When I have downtime, I have to sit and just be. I have time to deliberate. I have time to look out the window. I have time to listen to the breath that comes through my chest. And so I think that makes such a difference because there's time to then think about things and feel those connections instead of constantly be pounded and pounded and pounded by stimuli. We're so overstimulated by technology that we can never get to the heart of what's right there. There's a black bear walking down the street. There's a white squirrel eating my strawberries. There's just so much there to take joy in. And that's the wisdom that I get from Native people. They're not different than me. You know, when they cut themselves, they bleed. When, you know, their babies are born, they cry. We're not different at all. It's just that they found mechanisms to protect, to preserve that cultural connection through stories. And this film contains many, many stories that connect them to their generations going back tens of thousands of years. It connects them to the land. It connects them to each other, to their faith. And we have these stories too, but so often we're so focused on the story of, you know, what did this guy just text me about? You know, what is the TikTok thing that I'm watching? You know, the cat video that somebody just sent me.
And or I have to take a picture of that black bear that's walking down the street. Oh, wait a minute, I missed it. So rather instead of watching it and having the experience, watching what that bear does and how it ambles along and where it might stop along the way, what it reacts to, so focused on rushing for your phone and trying to take a picture or a video. But, you know, Eric, you had asked, what's the root of this? Like, how is this happening or why is this happening? And the thing that jumped to my mind was the marketing industrial complex. And marketing is a science and it's been successful for a reason because it makes people do things that somebody else wants you to do. It makes you do things that somebody else wants you to do without realizing it. So that, oh, you have to get that latest phone or you have to be going shopping instead of sitting outside.
David, if you were to distinguish between a modern person today who's caught up in the phone, who's bombarded with marketing messages, and someone, and you can use yourself as an example, who's someone who's more engaged in the world around them. And I don't mean just engaged by going out on the parkway and looking at mountains, but actually touching and feeling the soil and the plants and working with them. You talked, I think I read on a website, how you work with native materials and that brings you back to or closer connection with indigenous people. What's the difference in the daily routine for most of us and someone like yourself?
I don't know if my routine is all that different. Ironically, I'm using highly technical, I mean, I'm using software that's incredibly sophisticated that I've used for years and I still don't know half of it. I'm staring at screens to make these films, uploading things to YouTube and to Vimeo. I am transacting with so many of the people in my life through digital means and not through, you know, face to face. As I said, you know, before, you have to speak the language of the people you're talking to. And if I'm trying to reach not just fogies, but I'm trying to reach younger people, I have to speak that language, and I have to use medium where, you know, people are going to access it that way. And so that's the irony of the life that I live, is that you live in two worlds. Everyone does. Often, though, that maybe for me, I live a little bit more in that second world than some other people, because as soon as I can get away from the screen, I do. When COVID happened, we ended up moving, downscaling somewhat, and I put my studio in my basement. And so that makes it easier, because I can sit here in my bunny slippers and have this discussion with you. But it also means that as soon as I can take a break, I can run out, you know, and go to the garden for a few minutes, even if it's just to take a breath, even if it's just to relax and just watch everything happen around me. And it was so true what you were saying just before about seeing people on the mountaintop just taking pictures. I live just down the block from Carl Sandburg's place, Glassy Mountain. I try to walk that every day. And I go up there and look at the mountains and look at the trees. And, you know, so many people who I haven't seen before, they're just sitting there taking the picture and then they go down. And I just wonder, did they ever actually see it? You know, we think that we're having these experiences because we're posting it on social media. Right. I think probably that our friends are probably experiencing it more than we are, because we're never there in that moment. Just taking the time when we're away from this thing, the device thing, and being able to be who we really are, finding our authentic self. And I find the only way to find my authentic self, I have to be in nature. If I'm, you know, in the wintertime when I can't get out much, I'm more depressed just because it's hard. I don't like cold weather. And we don't have that much cold weather here, thank God. But having to be grounded in nature, I just try to grab some of that as much time as I can. Even with the busy life that I live and all the technology that's around me that I have to use to do my job.
We're talking with David Weintraub, and he's got a new film coming out called Nature's Wisdom Through Native Eyes. David, how can people learn more about the value of preserving cultures and how to advocate for it? And I asked that question because I think there's I get it. That could be happening among listeners. This makes a lot of sense to me, especially in Asheville. But what can folks do and think, and are there steps they can take to disrupt their use of the phone or to listen to marketing messages or to just get outside?
We're in ground zero of this all around us. I mean, I lived in so many places where if you wanted to connect with culture and history, the only way you could do that was under glass, you know, in some dust-filled room somewhere, or a museum or a library or something like that. And those are great places to have. But here we are in this bastion of both culture and nature. It's just amazing. There's cultural events going on all the time. There's concerts that are going on all the time. Storytelling that's going on all the time. I like to go to Quala Boundary as often as I can, just to kind of be connected to that area and to the culture that's going on there. To talk with the elders that I've met there. And I just find that it's kind of like taking this nice warm bath. It's just like being, you know, getting back to your native self, because we all are indigenous to some place. And again, you know, native people just to me are a great example, because they've been able to preserve that in just this fascinating way for 13,000 years when it comes to the Cherokee. So we can avail ourselves of that and find. I think the hardest thing for me as a filmmaker and an artist to do is to just stop. You know, I want to just continue. You know, this film that I'm working on now, and it's still not done. You know, I can do this now till the cows come home, until their great, great grandchildren cows come home. But you just have to know when to stop. And in every endeavor, I think we can stop and not overwhelm ourselves. The Iroquois used to say that in order to function in the world, you had to have skin of seven layers. And you have to do that, for one, to protect yourself against all the distractions that are banging against you, but also to protect yourself from all the supposed insults and attacks and all that you think are being shot at you, when usually when people are insulting you or criticizing what have you, it isn't about you at all, it's about them. And when you can just remember that we're all trying to struggle through this life together, and we're not so far apart. And that's what I've learned. You know, my first environmental film here in Western North Carolina was a film about farmers, Native farmers, and they're connecting to the land, and they're concerned about the future of farming. I showed that to a very liberal, progressive crowd, and I said after I showed it to them, it was a fairly short film. I said, if I walked into that one of those elders' houses and I started talking about climate change, how fast do you think they would have taken that rifle off the mantle and chased me out the door? You know, that's not the language. But if I spoke to them about stewardship and their connection to the land and what that meant to them and what that means to what meant to their granddaddy and what that means to their children, it's a completely different discussion. But it's the same thing. But we're so beholden to the way we think rather than understanding that the person down the block who seemingly has a different background than ourselves is not all that different.
Let's take it a little step further, because right now, Habanero and I are at the epicenter. We've got you here. So we're at the creative core. Let's say there's a listener out there. How does that listener say, hey, I really want to go see the show on the 24th? How does that listener talk to two or three people who may need some convincing? Help spread the word a little bit about how you can help folks convince their friends to go see your work.
Well, web, talking about technology, the website is saveculture.org, saveculture.org. And for every film, I make a series of trailers. I try to do it, you know, I'm trying to do a trailer a week. So there's three trailers up there right now on this film, Nature's Wisdom Through Native Eyes. You can go onto that website and there's a whole page on there and you can see the media that's come out so far. You can see the trailers, read something about the background and what other people have said about it. That's one way. And I find I have to use, it's integrative medicine, you know? And so we have to integrate technology into getting back into getting away from technology. And that's just the way it works. But, you know, watch the trailers. I feel different when I'm watching it, you know, even though I've watched it 5,000 times. I hate watching reruns. So that's the difficult thing about filmmaking is you have to watch your own film over and over and over again. But, you know, it separates, you just kind of feel separated from your existence and feel like there is something in you that's calling to you to be back to your authentic self and to take that break that you need. And so I try to create, you know, inspiring trailers that help connect people to the larger themes. But the film is just a medium. Why I love doing films live with people, and I try to do that more than most of my films go on PBS. They're on, you know, there's eight of my films right now broadcasting on public television around the country. But to me, that's fine. That's nice. It's an ego boost. But really, when I show a film to someone and we can have these discussions, then the issues that the films are trying to raise really come to light and really kind of shine. And that, to me, is the best way to see a film, is to be there in person, to talk to the filmmaker, to talk to the Native elders who are going to be there, to ask them the questions, and let the issues that the films are trying to inspire resonate with you in your own life. And that's why, you know, it's harder to do films that way. But to me, I'm an introvert. And so making films for me is great because a picture tells 1,000 words and a film tells 1,000,000 words. So I don't have to say quite so many words, you know, with this moment accepted. Art reaches a part in your life that the real world doesn't, you know, whether that be an oil painting or that be a sculpture, that be a story, and that be a film. And it does for me, if it's done in a way that comes from the heart rather than just from the intellect. We're too drowning in our intellect and not enough from the heart.
One of the things that you've mentioned that brings some words to my mind is how are you making that connection with people? And the phrase that I've heard is remembering. So it's like we all have it inside of us, these connections and these memories and this knowledge of how everything is interconnected, but we've somehow forgotten. And by reconnecting with that stuff, you can remember your place.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that. I think it's there. It's always in there. It's just takes more excavating than it ever did before, because again, there's so much distracting in our lives. We have to keep so busy. This economic system that we live in today keeps us on the run. It always comes back. I always think of the Charlie Chaplin movie Modern Times, where he's working on the line. They speed it up, and they speed up the line. He's walking home, and his hands and arms are still flashing, doing the motions that he was doing on that line. And that's kind of like our lives. We're constantly feeling that buzz of having to do, because the economic system we live in is forcing us to do. But we still have the opportunity to remember exactly. In stillness, there is hope. In stillness, there's a chance for us to find who we are. And I like meditation. The first thing I do in the morning is I meditate. I do a little Qigong. Whether it's sunny or rainy, I have a little deck that I kind of do that on. I like it this time of year when the leaves are out. Some neighbors don't think I'm some wacko out there doing these things. I need that. And I feel that's my cup of coffee. If I don't do that, I feel like I'm missing something. And I have to find some space in my life to get back to that.
How can mainstream educators integrate the lessons from our ancestors and the lessons you're talking about into their lessons? Because it seems to me like it's great to teach adults this and go see these films, but is there a way to get a younger audience engaged in some of this?
Well, I'm hoping this film will be part of that. There's a lot of animation. I had to do extra fundraising, and I found this young animator who from East Tennessee who's done a beautiful job. And there's a great deal. The stories that are told in the film are all animated. There's a number of things in the film that are animated, and I think that will help to bring that younger audience in. That's part of it. But ironically, I hated history as a kid. I just couldn't stand history. Just having to absorb all these facts about great men and great events, and it was, of course, men, not women, and I just couldn't stand it. But then, I had this one teacher, Mr. McCrohan, social studies teacher, and there was I don't know how long he did this. Maybe it was an hour, maybe it was a few hours. He talked about the Iroquois. I lived in New York, and so the Iroquois were the closest tribe near me. And it still resonates with me today, the fact that he spoke about the Iroquois and their traditions and their mask and their stories. So we can do that in the classroom by just spending some time with, I think storytelling is such a powerful way of doing that. The Jack Tales, the Native stories, the African-American story, there's so many stories or the language that I think stories are probably the first social media. Way before we had anything electronically. It was the way to capture the news and tell and connect people with their ancestors and connect people with the next generation.
David, we're really fortunate to have you. So would you share one more time the name of your film, where and when people can see it? Because that's storytelling.
Sure. Nature's Wisdom Through Native Eyes. I run the Center for Cultural Preservation, the website to find all this information. Many, many oral histories, this film, many other films, saveculture.org, saveculture.org. And the world premieres again are June 24th at North River Farms, June 29th at the Orange Peel, and July 1st at Trinity Presbyterian Church in Hendersonville.
Well, David, thank you very much. This has been fantastic, and I definitely want to see more of your work. Thank you for sharing and spending the time with us. And everybody have a great day. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.